Well, in the second session, we're going to try to look at the other side of all of this. It certainly is exciting, and the potential is tremendous. This technology may very well, in many ways, be a panacea for mankind, a cure-all for many, many diseases. On the other hand, it also has the characteristics of Pandora's box. That's an expression from Greek mythology. Pandora was the first woman, by the way. And part of the legend involves her opening a jar. It's become a box through tradition, but originally in the original, it was a, anyway, the point is she is warned not to do this, but her curiosity gets the better of her, and she opens it, and all evil in the world comes out of this box and so forth. So it's part of the mythology of the Greeks, but that term is in our literature, a Pandora's box, opening something that you don't know what's inside. And this one could be pretty spooky. Before we get into negatives, let's realize that there is a very serious war against disease. There are lots of brilliant, committed, dedicated people working hard in this area. So let's not overreact to some of the aspects of it and become some kind of activist nut, because there's some really, probably the best talent in the most promising young people going into this to fight disease. And the kinds of diseases that have been elusive, not tractable to remedies, look like they may yield to the technologies that are now emerging in front of us. AIDS, for example. Mental illness of all kinds of mental retardation, especially genetically conveyed ones. Autoimmune diseases, obesity, Alzheimer's disease, Parkinson's disease, Huntington's disease, Lou Gehrig's disease, heart disease, cancer. Cancer is a catch-all for lots of these. It's the leading cause of death after heart disease, 24% of all. 40% of Americans have or will have cancer, and 20% will die from it. 30% of these are caused by smoking, 30% by poor diet and lack of exercise. Cancer. It's really some kind of regulatory anomaly in the cell process that causes it to reproduce when it shouldn't. That's caused tumor growths or not reproducing when it should. Genetic remedies of all kinds, mental retardation, muscular dystrophy, cystic fibrosis, leukemia, a lot of these that you probably never even heard of. And trust me, you don't want to know what they are. It's interesting, though, as this technology moves, we do know that there are limits of what man can contrive to do. Back in Genesis chapter 11, there was a situation where now nothing will be restrained from them which they have imagined to do. Emphasize imagined. Now, if you start talking about the bizarre aspects of this technology, the kind of things you can imagine are really bizarre. And in the past, when we reached those kind of boundaries, God intervened. He did back in Genesis 11. And many people suspect that because of the possibilities of this technology, the technology itself is an indicator that we're moving into the end times. Dr. Richard Seed is a very, very qualified expert in cloning. And he made a statement on National Public Radio that we've recorded. I want you to understand where some of this incredible competence can be mixed with a little ego and emerge with a very, very disturbing philosophy. Are we ready for the track? Okay, go ahead and play it.
God made man in his own image. God intended for man to become one with God. We are going to become one with God. We are going to have almost as much knowledge and almost as much power as God. Cloning and the reprogramming of DNA is the first serious step in becoming one with God. Very simple philosophy.
Gives you a flavor of the kind of thinking that pervades some of the articles and some of the leadership. And recognize that these are not concentrated projects in just a few laboratories. You're dealing with thousands of centers around the world racing to make their name by being the first. There are many of these that have the philosophy of approach, let's try it, if we have a problem, we'll fix it later. And of course, that's insanity in many ways, especially with this kind of technology. So there are growing concerns. There are few safeguards against errors or abuse. There can be honest, well-intended errors that go awry. You're dealing with microscopic things that are replicating, mutating, and not lend themselves to control. And this, of course, is a very popular theme in many of the science fiction entertainments. Back in the Andromeda strain, back in 1970, dealt with some of these ideas. And we've had many other more recent ones of this kind. Cross-species implications. By the way, mad cow disease came from sheep. There's a sheep disease that somehow, and they're not sure exactly how, there's conjectures, got into cows. The fact that some of it was ground up and fed to cows is not an explanation how it got into their system. Just because you ingest something doesn't mean it necessarily gets absorbed. But in this case, some strange things did. And there's the cross-species implications are terrifying for lots of reasons. See, they're different diseases in different species. If you have pets, if you have birds, you're very conscious if you have a cold. You stay away from them because they can catch colds. Dogs don't. They get distemper, but not from a cold. The point is the kinds of diseases that plague various pets are different than would plague you in general. When you start having diseases cross-species somehow, you're starting to create all kinds of unknown diseases and complications. That's when they start fooling around growing a human ear on a rat. It's a very novel picture, but I don't think you want one of those grafted on your ear until you knew a lot more about the kind, well, a lot more about a lot of things. But strange, strange time. The potential for self-replicating mutations. That's part of the problem with AIDS, apparently. They're all impossible to fully anticipate. You're throwing dice here with no idea what the outcome might be. Scary stuff. And this is in an environment where there's very few regulatory or procedural disciplines. We're not talking about a highly disciplined, regimented environment like a government lab or even a large chemical company. It has traditions and procedures over the years. You're talking about startups of guys that are in a hurry without the, can't afford the luxury of some safeguards. Small, intensely competitive laboratories, few established labs of any kind. Let's take just one example that's real and recent. Genetically altered corn. Starlink was bred. It was corn spliced with a powerful toxin. Bacillus thuringiensis, I guess it is. But a particular one of these that is turned out to be, and the idea was, of course, to make it intrinsic pesticide. This controversial Cry9C variety is 50 to 100 times more potent than other BT-spliced insecticide. The critics warned that unfamiliar foreign proteins could set off dangerous food allergies in humans. A food allergy, by the way, is the immune system's overreaction to something. And this could have symptoms ranging from fever, rashes, diarrhea, anaphylactic shock, and sudden death. And because of that, the FDA approved it only for animal feed. I don't know if you still feel, knowing all this, you still don't feel so good about it being in your hamburgers. Okay? All right? Well, they discovered that some of this feed was getting into the system, in the food system. Kraft, the largest food corporation in America, had to recall 2.5 million boxes of corn tacos. That was just the beginning. The USDA recalled all, Starlink was the brand name of the Starlink corn, on 350,000 acres planted across the U.S. Now, they also find out that fields adjacent to that got cross-pollinated, and the soil got, it turns out to be far more complicated, but there are over 400 brands of tortillas, shells, tostadas, and chips recalled from thousands of supermarkets throughout the U.S. The largest U.S. food processors, Kellogg, ConAgra, Archer Daniels Midland, and Tyson, These are the largest. They shut down their grain mills. The economic repercussions just beginning. Aventis, Kraft, Safeway, Mission Foods, Western Family, Shaw's, Food Lion, Randall's, Kroger, Albertsons, and so forth, dozens of others, plus all the grain elevators and farmers, face several $100 million in losses, setting aside the lawsuits. Consumers are claiming to have been poisoned by Starlink corn products that filed multi-million-dollar class action suits against all, everybody. The international implications are substantial. International producers of genetically engineered crops, United States 74% of them, Canada 10%, Argentina 15%. They're the dominant three countries involved. the economic sanctions that are deriving from this. By the way, in all of this, the U.S. government said it's okay to ship the stuff to foreign. Let's get it off our markets, ship it to foreign. Well, that went over big abroad, you can imagine. Economic sanctions could threaten the meltdown of the entire global free trade system, is the estimate by some. And the Center for Food Safety says American consumers have been used as unknowing guinea pigs in all of this. It's crossing borders. Pollen from the BT corn kills monarch butterflies. Just one data point. Mexico is the winter home for monarch butterflies who migrate south from Canada and the United States. It's also killing beneficial soil microorganisms and thus damaging the whole soil food web, as well as killing beneficial insects such as lacewings and ladybugs and what have you. And then we have antibiotic-resistant marker genes, ARMs, found in genetically engineered foods and animal feeds. We find that they have the ability to transfer antibiotic resistance to soil bacteria, bees, mammals, and other organisms, including humans. If you have resistance to antibodies, you know, that creates further problems, giving rise to dangerous pathogens in humans that can't be killed by traditional antibiotics. That's becoming a problem anyway. This is going to intensify. The FDA admits that 8% of all U.S. children are now plagued by food allergies, and that situation is growing worse. Nutritionists warn of a suspected link between food allergies and asthma. The FDA's 1989 recall of genetically engineered nutritional supplement tryptophan still left 37 deaths and 5,000 injuries. And the New England, very conservative journal, New England Journal of Medicine, has said that unlabeled genetically engineered foods are uncertain, unpredictable, and untestable. The last one is really scary. And all this leads, strangely enough, to super pests. There are now emergent markets for seeds with confirmed pedigrees for organic farming. More and more people are concerned about this. There's private networks emerging where you can buy seeds of known background, so they're not genetically altered. However, crop pests, beetles, bollworms, corn borers, will inevitably develop resistance to widely cultivated BT spice crops, which will then create super pests that could overwhelm even organic farmers and even make organic agriculture more difficult, if not impossible. So this is just one case study, the whole corn thing, and there are others. The moral and ethical obstacles to genetic manipulation are substantial, especially in Germany and Denmark. That's what drove many of the scientists to practice in the U.S., because it was looser here. Objections, in spite of all this, are gradually eroding, and effective controls remain elusive. The efforts are distributed among small startups, and legal issues are undefined. Let's zero right in on the big one, tampering with the human genome. And are there biblical precedents? Now, there are some examples. Genesis 6 is one of those. Not just before the flood, but in Genesis 6, verse 4, it says also after that. The Rephaim. Most people don't know about the Rephaim. I want to talk a little bit about that. And Jesus said, as the days of Noah were, so shall the days of the coming of the Son of Man be. Now, what he may have meant in context is just that it was business as usual until the Lord came back. There are some, though, that believe that remark includes an overtone that we need to understand the days of Noah, which, of course, were characterized by the strange goings-on in Genesis 6. And this also may have an implication on the strange vision in Daniel 2 with the miry clay. We'll touch back on that, and we'll talk about the coming one, the Antichrist, call him by what you will. You need to remember where he comes from. Everybody argues he's a Jew or Gentile. That's not the issue. Revelation 11 and Revelation 17 identify his source. He comes out of the Abuso. So what does that mean? Genesis 6, many people who read it fail to recognize that the first two verses are a single sentence. That's very important. It came to pass when men began to multiply on the face of the earth that daughters were born unto them, that the sons of God saw the daughters of men that they were fair, and they took them wives of all which they chose. And I'll indicate right up front, we're going to present this in the classical way as it was understood by the ancient Hebrew scholars, as it was translated into Greek 3 centuries before Christ was born, as it was understood by the early church, that the sons of God term refers to fallen angels. Angels can't have sex. The Bible doesn't say that. It says the angels in heaven don't marry. Different issue. I would not deny any technology to a fallen angel bent on mischief. Be careful about that one. In any case, these two verses are a single sentence. The debate occurs about the sons of God. In the Hebrew, it's B'nai HaElohim. It's a term used always in the Old Testament of angels. It's also in the book of Enoch. Not that it's a, don't misunderstand me, it's not an inspired book, but it was a very dominant piece of literature several centuries before Christ to several centuries afterward. And it certainly demonstrates the grammar and vocabulary of the period. And it makes it quite clear what the term means. But perhaps most persuasive of all is the Septuagint translation, when the world's experts, three centuries before Christ was born, translated the Hebrew scriptures into Greek. They translated this term precisely. Now, the fourth verse of that famous chapter, Genesis 6, says, there were Nephilim in the earth in those days. And also after that, when the sons of God came in unto the daughters of men, and they bare children to them, and the same became mighty men, which were of old, men of renown. The word Nephilim means the fallen ones. It comes from the verb nephal, to fall, be cast down, to fall away, desert. When translated into Greek, that passage was translated as gigantes, which means earthborn. It happens they were giants, and so it's translated in your English Bible as giants, but the term actually means earthborn. But the scripture even is more precise at painting the picture I'm trying to suggest here. In the ninth verse of that chapter, it points out that the generations of Noah, these are the generations of Noah. Noah was a just man and perfect in his generations, and Noah walked with God. Now, we know what a family tree is, but the word perfect in the Hebrew is tamim, which means without blemish, sound, healthful, without spot, unimpaired. It's always used of physical defects. What the verse 9 of chapter 6 says is one of the distinctives of Noah was that he had an unblemished genealogy, and apparently untainted by the goings-on, by these weird happenings. And so when Jesus says in Matthew 24:37, as the days of Noah were, so shall the coming of the Son of Man be, he may have meant that just in a denotative sense, business as usual, or he may have meant something even more profound. And that's one of the issues that undergird some of our briefing packages, the return of the Nephilim and also our book, Alien Encounters, and so on. I'm presenting a controversial view because it's very commonly taught what's called the lines of Seth view. That emerged in the 5th century. It has no scriptural support, although it's a popular view. The fallen angel view, which I'm presenting here, it was the view of the ancient Hebrew scholars. It was the view of the early church. It prevails among conservative scholarship today, and it's confirmed twice in the New Testament, in Jude, verses 6 and 7, in 2 Peter 2, verses 4 and 5, and there's a few other places also. It's interesting that all the ancient legends of all the ancient cultures on the earth carry variations of the same myth, or same, I shouldn't say same myth. They have myths celebrating the same apparent historical event. In Sumer, Assyria, Egypt, Incas, Mayan, Gilgamesh, Persia, Greece, India, Bolivia, South Sea Islands, even the Sioux Indians. The Indians had a tradition of being fearful of six-figured people. When we talk about Hercules or Atlas in the Greek, you're really talking in the Hebrew, the Nephilim, hybrids between the gods and the humans is the idea. The angel view is the traditional rabbinical literature, the Book of Enoch, as I mentioned, Testimony of the Twelve. These are all documents, Josephus, Flavius, Septuagint. The early church fathers, Philo, Justin Martyr, Irenaeus, Athenagoras, Tertullian, Lactantius, Ambrose, and Julian, all held to this view. Modern scholarship, Pember, DeHaan, McIntosh, Dillich, Gable, and Pink, Barnhouse, Morris, Unger, Fuchtenbaum, Hal Lindsey, Chuck Smith, all would have taught what I call the angel view. The Sethite view that many people have has a number of things. I will not go through all of these. Simply to say it's easy to shred from a biblical point of view. What you need to do, though, as we indulge in this topic, understand the role of Genesis 6. It was Satan's strategy to corrupt Adam's line to prevent the advent of a Messiah, because God had declared that the Messiah would come from a man. So if you can corrupt the human line, that would be one of Satan's gambits. Of course, it failed because God erased the blackboard with the flood. It started with the eight-core beginning. And as God reveals his plan of redemption, Satan's allowed to focus his attack on Abraham when he's declared, and the destruction of the male line in Exodus 1, Pharaoh's pursuit of Israel, even after letting them go after the Passover, Exodus 14, and so on. The one I want to focus on is the populating of Canaan. In Genesis 12, God tells Abraham that his descendants will come back after 400 years to populate the land. Well, that gives Satan an opportunity. He's got four centuries to lay down a minefield. And you may recall in Genesis 6, it said that these things were in the land and also after that. In other words, it happened again. There are Nephilim after the flood. The best example of that is when Moses sends out the 12 spies to spy out the land from Kadesh Barnea. In Numbers 13, verse 33, it says that there were Nephilim in the land. They were giants. They were terrified. 10 of them were shook up. Only 2, Joshua and Caleb, said, "Hey, Lord's on our side, let's go get them." And you know the story. Genesis 4, only after that. There were certain tribes in Genesis 14 and 15 defined as the Nephilim. The Rephaim, the Emim, the Horim, and the Zamzumim were Nephilim. What is that? How did it happen? We don't know. Were there more messing around by fallen angels? Don't know. But clearly there were Rephaim, and we want to talk a little about that. The word Rephaim is often translated dead in your English translation. Lots of places. They're almost uniform. The Rephaim were a tribe, but they became synonymous with the dead. Arba, Anak, and the seven sons, the Anakim, they were encountered in Canaan, Numbers 13, 32. These are Nephilim. Og, the king of Bashan, Deuteronomy 3 and Joshua 12. Goliath and his four brothers. That's why David took 5 stones when he crossed to confront Goliath. He was ready for all of them. And the other 4 are dealt with in 2 Samuel 21. But the Nephilim. By the way, you go up to the Golan Heights, there is Gilgal, Rephaim. They found monuments. They're really relatively unexplored archaeologically. But these are real people that lived in those times. Now, all through the Old Testament, you find these places that really shock the New Testament reader. Here's an example in 1 Samuel 15:3. Where they're instructed, "Now go and smite Amalek and utterly destroy all that they have and spare them not, but slay both man and woman, infant, suckling, ox, sheep, camel, and ass." Why? You know, we read that and we get shocked. You know, kill the men, you know, accomplish your military goal, great. Wipe out every man, woman, and child. Why? Because they're Rephaim. And where they don't, they have trouble. When Saul doesn't kill Agag, one of his descendants is Haman that tries to wipe out the Jews in Bethsaida. But there's other examples. In any case, there's a strange passage in Isaiah 26, verse 14, which in the Hebrew implies that the Rephaim, it says the dead shall not live, but that's in the English, the Rephaim shall not live, they are deceased, they shall not rise, therefore thou hast visited and destroyed them and made all their memory to perish, the prophet says. So from this, some theologians believe that the Rephaim, the Nephilim, were not eligible for resurrection. Why? Because Christ did not become a Rephaim and die for them. Now what happened to the Nephilim in the flood? Well, they drowned. Yes, but what happened to their spirits or souls? Call it what you will. There's a big distinction between the demons of the New Testament and the fallen angels. The fallen angels can materialize. They can engage in combat. They can do all kinds of things. Demons are powerless unless they can indwell a person. Could the demons possibly be the disembodied spirits of the Nephilim? That's a conjecture by some. Let's shift on another thing. Nebuchadnezzar has this famous dream in Daniel 2, which turns out to be a profile. Daniel interprets it for us. He not only reveals to Nebuchadnezzar the dream, but he also interprets it for us that this strange metallic image, head of gold, arms and chest of silver, belly and thighs of brass, legs of iron, and the feet iron mixed with clay, is a timeline of Gentile history. The gold, silver, brass, iron mixed with clay. It's actually 4 empires. And we know that it's Daniel interprets it. There's Babylon. It's succeeded by Persia, by Greece, and then by Rome, but in 2 phases. We'll call Rome 1 and Rome 2. And most scholars recognize that the same idioms are used for that empire, but in 2 distinct phases, where it breaks up into pieces and then gets recoalesces in the later years. And a stone comes and hits the image at the feet in the dream. That stone becomes a mountain and fills the whole earth. And it's a famous vision in Daniel 2. We won't go into detail here. But in Daniel 7, Daniel himself gets a series of visions that are the same subject with different idioms. A series of beasts, winged lion, a bear on one side, a leopard, and terrible beast. And again, it parallels the same profile. And again, the fourth empire is in 2 phases. But what mystifies many is that there's a great deal of discussion about this fourth empire in which the feet. On the one hand, we know that the iron mixed with clay, the 10 heads that grows in the beast, is the final phase, the final world empire, that God himself intervenes interrupts and sets up his own kingdom. But one of the characteristics of this final world, whether you're talking about the 10 toes, the image of the 10 heads of Daniel 7, won't focus on that here. But one of the characteristics that's dominant in Daniel 2 is that we have the iron is mixed with clay, miry clay. What makes this difficult, it's in Aramaic, not Hebrew. What is miry clay? Well, miry clay is clay made from mire or dust. It's very brittle. But Daniel interprets miry clay for us if we read the verse very carefully. In Daniel 2, verse 43, when Daniel gets to this point, he says, whereas thou sawest iron mixed with miry clay, comma, they, personal pronoun, they, shall mingle themselves with the seed of men. But they shall not cleave one to another, even as iron is not mixed with clay. Now, the first point that grammatically emerges here, and I've had this checked out, is that they have to be something other than the seed of men to mingle. They're distinct. You know, that's the whole point of mingling, is there's two distinct things that are getting commingled. So that they are something other than the seed of men. Now, whether these are Nephilim, like Genesis 6, or whether there's some kind of other alien being, who knows? Or is this some kind of cloning illusion? Who knows? This is highly conjectural. I share it with you for your own perusal. The context of the dream, though, implies that the they, whoever they are, constitute a significant political constituency. It's not a scattered item or two. And so that's very provocative. When we get to Revelation, we have the chapter 6, the seven-sealed scroll that the Lamb opens up. And we're all familiar with the white horse, the red horse, the black horse, and the green horse, which, of course, the four horsemen of the apocalypse. And then there's several other seals. Well, it's interesting. It's this green horse. It says, and his name that sat on him was death, and hell followed with him, and power was given unto them over the fourth part of the earth to kill with the sword, with hunger, with death, and with the beasts of the earth. And I throw this in here, only consider this, that when we think of beasts of the earth, we always presume they're four-footed mammals. The possibility exists that they may be microbial. And it's interesting, as we discover, as we just start looking at the microscopic side of the animal world, there are such things as intelligent intruders that violate our bodies and violate our cells. And we now discover some interesting things about bacteria, which is what we're talking about. They apparently, we now learn, indulge in quorum sensing. They're able to take roll call. The E. coli, the Salmonella, the bacteria that causes cholera, and 30 others all have this characteristic. If they're in the body and they attack too soon, the antibodies will overwhelm them. So they don't want to attack until they feel there's enough of their number that they've got a chance at winning. So they take muster. And they've discovered now that bacteria, these simple single-cell creatures, can take roll call. I'm here, so am I, and they take count. And what they can sense when they think there's enough of them to make it worthwhile, they go attack. And scientists are trying to find how they really communicate, because if they can stop the communication, they can render them powerless. It's interesting, in Luke chapter 14, the Lord himself draws an analogy. He says, what king going to make war against another king sitteth not down first and consulteth whether he be able with 10,000 to meet him that cometh against him with 20,000? Or else, while the other's yet a great way off, he sendeth an ambassage and desireth conditions of peace. It's interesting, there's an article in Scientific American recent months about how insects swarm, because they've discovered they communicate in some ways that they believe, if they can understand, it'll help us solve some of our computer software problems. Routing problems and so forth. They're actually looking at them and trying to understand, because that's one of the more elusive problems in mathematics is solving some of these network problems. And these things are communicating in very simple ways and yet very complex ways, depending how you look at it. Okay, there's also cross-species diseases. We talked about that. Mad cow's disease is an example of that. But if we start cross-cloning, it gets even scarier. Retroviruses, we talked about, can skip generations. Then there's such things as directable intruders. We find this in our fiction already. If you saw Mission Impossible 2, the plan was to create a very, very virulent form of disease called chimera. Chimera was, again, drawing upon Greek mythology. Had a head of a lion, a goat growing out of his back, and his tail was a serpent. And it terrorized, in mythology, terrorized the region until Bellerophon came and with Pegasus slaughtered, you know, there's a whole thing. But the Bellerophon is the superhero, And to have a superhero, you need a supervillain. That's Chimera. And they use that in the plot line. But the plot line is built on this whole idea of biotechnology, where you're starting to use it as a weapon. Before I get to another point, the whole area of nanotechnology is a briefing in its own right. This is the attempt by scientists in a totally different area to create molecular-sized machines. And just recently, a few days ago, the scientists at the Institute of Material Science and Technical University of Dresden combined DNA with palladium and made nanometer wires which conduct at room temperature. And they feel this is a major first step in starting to create nanotechnology, actually create circuits and machinery in the nanometer region, you know, billionth of a meter size, tiny, tiny things. Well, this leads to another issue that I'll just touch upon in this briefing. There is a field called nanotechnology that has as its goal molecule-sized machines, making them to our design. And that's why they take such interest in DNA, because DNA does it itself automatically. Then there's the field of robotics. And the goal here is to create self-modifying sentient machines. Machines that can, let me not say they think, that's an ambiguous term, that can simulate cognitive behavior. And that can self-modify themselves for certain tasks. That's a very advanced field, actually. The whole field of artificial intelligence, pattern recognition, is really part of that world. And then, of course, the field of genetics. These three technologies are converging. They're not really separate. Some of the biggest opportunities are always between disciplines rather than within them. So as nanotechnologies and robotics and genetics converge, there are several goals, but perhaps the most terrifying one has been expressed as creating self-replicating sentient machines capable of directable diseases targeting specific groups or individuals. Designing a disease that will seek out and only affect people with a certain DNA profile, certain groups or even individuals. Now that should scare you to death. Can you imagine what a Stalin or a Hitler could have done with that kind of technology? And that kind of technology is not very far away. And then, of course, we have, just doing a little survey in the scripture, we have the trumpet judgments, where we have the, after the seals, you have the trumpets and the bowls. And the fifth one, in chapter 9 of Revelation, these demon locusts are rather provocative. And I won't go through all of this here in the interest of time, except that these strange locusts have power as the, if you notice, verse 3, as the scorpions of the earth have power, whatever that means. It's commanded them, they should not hurt the grass of the earth, nor any green thing, nor any tree, but only those men which have not the seal of God in their foreheads. To them it was given that they should not kill them, but that they should be tormented 5 months. And the torment was as the torment of a scorpion which striketh a man. And it goes on, describes the very strange looking creatures. Many people, you know, they have, they're like horses prepared into battle. Their heads were, as it were, crowns of gold. Their faces are the faces of men. And they had breastplates of iron. Sound of their wings was as the sound of chariots of many horses running the battle. And their tails were like unto scorpions, the stings in their tails. And they had power to hurt men 5 months. This is why some Bible teachers they tend to visualize this as being helicopters. You can sort of visualize that as a possibility. I think there's another clue here in verse 11. They had a king over them, which is the angel of the bottomless pit, whose name in the Hebrew tongue is Abaddon, and the Greek tongue hath his name Apollyon. Well, it's interesting. Proverbs 30, verse 27 tells us the locusts have no king. These locusts have a king, which tells us what? They're not natural locusts. They're demonic. And the same thing we discover with Gog. When you look at Amos 7, 1, we discover in the English it makes no sense at all. But in the Septuagint, he hath shown me, and behold, a swarm of locusts were coming, and behold, one of the young devastating locusts was Gog the king. So suddenly we get an insight in Ezekiel 38 that Gog is clearly the leader of Magog, but he's also a demon king of some kind. That solves all kinds of problems in our understanding the prophetic scenario. Well, we've talked about tampering with the human genome, iron mixed with the clay, the pale horse of Revelation, the demon locust. Let's get to the really bizarre, the most bizarre one of all. And this one, this one is pretty weird. There are serious people that are going to attempt to clone Jesus. Clone Jesus Project. The concept is they want to get a DNA sample from a religious relic. There's several they're considering, but the Shroud of the Turin is the one that's that they're targeting. Now, if they go through with this, and if they should succeed, they might be in for a surprise, because there are some that believe the shroud is actually of Jacques de Molay. He was the last Grand Master of the Knights Templar, and he was executed in a parody of the crucifixion in 1314. And there are some experts that are very convinced that that shroud is really his, not that of Christ. But so if they get that DNA, they've got a surprise coming. But the main idea is they want to take the DNA sample and do a nuclear transfer to a stem cell and have a virgin surrogate mother then bring it to full term. And there are apparently 40 women that are a part of this group that are going to do this. And they've got a date set, December 25th, 2001. So I love it when they do that. We just sit back and watch and see. This overlooks a lot of problems. But it's interesting that they tie all this to a calendar revision, which is consistent with Daniel 7:25. But what they overlook is there's a lot of research that has to go on before this is even feasible, even though it looks like it will be feasible downstream. But we also need to look at the risks. When Dolly the sheep was cloned, it took 276 failures before one was successful. And those failures are not just for the embryo, they also endanger the surrogate mother. So they're messing around in dangerous biology, and they certainly are messing around in dangerous theology. But it's interesting, there is a fictional novel built on these ideas called the Clone Jesus Trilogy, where a guy tries to do this and clone Jesus. He ends up becoming the Antichrist. It's a very, very colorful story. So if you've read Left Behind, you want something that's a little more technical, a little more bizarre, then you might want to look into the Clone Jesus Trilogy, but to keep you awake nights. But as you talk about these topics of the Antichrist, so if you start talking about the enforcing of the worship of an image, people who know nothing else about the Bible know about the verse 18 of Revelation 13. He causes all, both small and great, rich and poor, free and bond, to receive a mark in their right hand and on their foreheads. Notice where they get the mark, on their right hand or on their foreheads. That no man may buy or sell, save that he had the mark or the name of the beast or the number of his name. And here's wisdom, let him that hath understanding count the number of the beast, for it is the number of a man. And his number is 666. People who know nothing else about the Bible are familiar with this verse. And the 666, of course, has been a subject of discussion for 1900 years. And if you take in the Greek, the word Christos, the first and last letters, and then you take this other curly little Greek letter, and you get the three letters that refer to the Antichrist. By the way, Antichrist is an unfortunate term. The term means something different today than it did then. The word Antichristo in the Greek really means the pseudo-Christ, in the place of Christ. And that has a little different complexion. But if you take those three letters, they have numerical value in the Greek. So it's 600 plus 60 plus 6, which gives you this famous 666. And there are all kinds of people who have written articles about barcodes, because 6 is used as a separator. So behind certain ones of the barcodes, you've got a hidden 666. So they make a big thing of that. And everybody has had their theories about what the 666 means. It is apparently gematria, but if you want to make it gematria, you need to know there are 7 formal forms of gematria. And if you go through these, you'll learn something very quickly. You can prove anything with gematria. In the computer industry, we have an expression that summarizes, if you torture the data long enough, it'll confess to anything. But the other thing I think it's overlooked here is whose number. See, many people, the reason I bring this up in this briefing is so many people talk biotech, they get all caught up with the insertable chips under your skin or barcodes as the implementation technology. Clearly, that technology can implement the control of financial transactions and provide the political wherewithal to do this as time goes on. But everybody overlooks that it's his number that people take, and it's his number that's the critical identity issue. Taking his number or name is what prevents you from ever being saved. And that's something we don't have to worry about. We believe we'll be out of here by then. That's a whole other eschatological issue. But the only physical description of the Antichrist in the Bible that I know of is in Zechariah 11, the last verse of that chapter, 11:17. Woe to the idol shepherd, I-D-O-L, the idol shepherd, that leaveth the flock. The sword shall be upon his arm and upon his right eye. His arm shall be clean dried up, and his right eye shall be utterly darkened. It doesn't tell us which arm, but you sort of infer it's the right side that this is all involved with. Since in the book of Revelation, several times it emphasizes that he has a head wound that's healed, miraculously, presumably. And the possibility that emerges here, a conjecture, possibly, yes, he gets recovered, but not completely, that he has an impairment from that injury, that head wound, his right eye and his arm. And it may be that at that time, his followers, seeking to identify themselves with him, take on some kind of identity. It's taking on his identity. It's the issue, not having a number to do transactions. Now, that under that administration, you won't be able to do transactions unless you have his name, so you've got a confrontation. But the point is, there's nothing wrong with a credit card, debit card, in the sense that theologically the issue is taking up an identity with this leader who will then be, of course, blaspheming God. And much is said about him. He has 33 different titles in the Old Testament, 13 in the New, separate study. When you start talking about a clone, though, I'll just throw this one at you. Everybody puzzles about Revelation 17, verse 11, where it speaks of the Antichrist, this world, or should say this world leader, and the beast that was and is not, and even he is the eighth and is of the seven, and goeth into perdition. What does that mean? Well, lots of commentaries have different conjectures, but I just threw out one that they haven't probably discussed, and that's the possibility he's a clone, that he's one of the seven. I'm not going to suggest that's true. I'm just leaving that out as something for you to mull over on the way home tonight. But the other thing I should mention when you start talking about all these things is the removal of the restrainer. In 2 Thessalonians 2, a major milestone in eschatology is this restrainer that's going to be removed in 2 Thessalonians 2. He may be restraining far more than we have any idea. He certainly is. His removal is a prerequisite condition of the identity, the revealing of this man of sin, the son of perdition, this world leader. But I suspect he's restraining far more than just that. I think after his removal, the world will prove to be far more bizarre than we have any capacity to imagine. I would be hesitant to do a science fiction movie of what it's like after restrainer, because I think you could easily justify that it's going to be far stranger than would fly in terms of a piece of entertainment. But Jesus himself said, except those days should be shortened, there should no flesh be saved, but for the elect's sake those days shall be shortened. Well, as we start looking at these technologies, the nuclear cloud that hung over our society over the last 50 years is probably pale compared to the kind of clouds that biotechnology run amok might be presenting society in the decades ahead. And strangely enough, that also may be an eschatological sign, because unless those days should be shortened, there'd no flesh be saved. Once again, just as in Genesis 11, God may intervene to accomplish his purpose. To just to summarize a few key lessons of this discussion, the main thing I'm hoping you'll carry away from this as we get into biotechnology, as we watch the discoveries, is to recognize the irrefutable evidence of design. The origin of information is what cannot be explained. The idea of irreducible complexity refutes design by accident or chance. It was very deliberate. The choreography, what goes on in the cell, defies random theories. In fact, it even defies being orchestrated by the information in the DNA. Let me explain what I mean by that, because that may not be clear. Let's imagine everyone in this audience had the skill, the knowledge, to play every possible musical instrument. And let's assume we had among us all the musical instruments we might dream of. And let's assume I handed each one of you a complete comprehensive orchestration of the symphony. All the players, all the pieces, everything that was in. I mean, copy one, each had a complete copy. Would we have a symphony? The answer is no. Because there's an issue, we need a conductor. We need someone to decide. You're going to be first violin. You're going to be percussion. You're going to be this or that, whatever. To define roles and missions. That can't be spontaneous. That's got to be external. If you start looking at this from an information equation point of view, it requires external input to cause it to have order. Just having the information individually is still insufficient. And that's why some specialists would argue that there has to be an external coordinator, external to that first cell, external to all the cells. And that connection was extant with Adam and Eve before they sinned. They were connected to the source of life. And from that day on, of course, a split took place. The digital codes demand pre-planning. And no system dependent upon subsystems can survive random failures. If you have a system that consists of a lot of subsystems and the subsystems are not redundant, an attack on one of the subsystems, if you're dependent on it, kills the whole entity. That also argues against any probabilistic randomness. This all happened by random chance. The fact that all cells derive from preceding cells is a profound truth to think through here. Well, we've talked, I just got a couple of things I want to postscript in here. We talked originally about our map to physical reality. and human body and organs and tissues we have experience with. We, through this little exposure, we talked about cells and molecular robots to get a flavor for what's going on there. I won't spend any time on atomic structure per se, or even subatomic particles. I do want to focus at the other boundary condition here, because there are some discoveries that we don't need to get in the details of, but do affect our perspective of the whole. And that's the area of hyperspaces. Nachmanides in the 12th century discovered from his study of Genesis chapter 1, he concluded the universe has 10 dimensions. Only 4 are knowable, 6 are not knowable in his mind. Today, the particle physicists will present arguments that the universe has 10 dimensions. Only 4 are directly measurable, length, width, height, and this elusive thing called time. 6 are curled in less than 10 to the minus 33 centimeters. And again, what's fascinating about this discovery is it's consistent with what Nachmanides discovered 800 years ago. But more than that, this whole area of hyperspaces has some other implications that affect our thinking here. David Bohm was a protege of Einstein and one of the world's most respected quantum physicists. He did landmark work in plasma physics, and that's what first got him fascinated, because plasmas, collections of ions, behave as an organ in some strange ways that attracted his attention. And from that background, he believed that at the subatomic level, location ceased to exist. Location being a focus, a point, that there's no longer space, there's no longer a locality, as they would call it. And that was his concept. A guy by the name of John Bell, back in 1964, operating at the Atomic Energy Facility in Europe, in Geneva, he formulated a mathematical approach to demonstrating non-locality. He did it conceptually. He formed a famous equation, or an inequality, the Bell inequality. But there wasn't technology in those days to prove it. However, in 1982, Alan Aspect and his associates, Jean Delabarre and Gerard Roger, at the Institute of Theoretical Applied Optics in Paris, conducted a landmark experiment. I won't take you through the technicalities of it, except they shocked the physics world by demonstrating that some atomic particles have no locality. What does that mean? That all protons, all electrons in the world know what the other ones are doing. That's why when I go back and I watch the choreography of the cell, what mystifies me is who's doing the choreography. We're not talking about ballet dancers that you can communicate with that have knowledge, that have like these are automated robots, elegant, but still at the molecular level, they're a group of atoms. How do they know when to stop what they've normally been doing and everybody go to the sidelines because we've got a whole different phase we're going into? This whole orchestration, this whole choreography is orchestrated. It's choreographed. Who does that? We don't know. We give the various phases that we observe fancy names. We have no idea why they do these things. And so the suspicion lurks that maybe the answer to that will emerge from the subatomic level, that they're connected to a hyperspace that we know little about. That's what Paul would call the spiritual world. The physical world is a special case within a larger reality. Well, let's move on. One of the great tragedies of all of this is what I call tragedy of myopia, the force-fitting of discoveries into obsolete models. It fascinates me to go through these texts on molecular biology and see them try to explain these things in terms of evolution, because that's the idiom, that's the political correct view within that career field. If you don't have that view, you got career problems. And yet, it's so strange. Every place you turn, as you look at, they try to explain these things, it makes no sense. In fact, if anything, molecular biology is the ultimate refutation of Darwin with the DNA and the rest of it. But Romans 1:20 is applicable here, like no place else, that there's enough evidence there to hold them all without excuse. Now, the key issue is not chemistry, it's information. And the best example of that in our life, immediate concept, is the Jurassic Park, the movie. These giant dinosaurs were resurrected by what? A piece of information. Getting a DNA out of the blood of a mosquito, a prehistoric, those are all just the mechanics. What they needed was the DNA. With the DNA, and Michael Crichton's novel, of course, is fictional, but it's not a stretch very far of current technology. Now, you and I have a genetic defect we haven't talked about. It's a retrovirus. It's of sin. Speaking of retrovirus, I want to make another point. We were giving this talk recently, and I was approached by a doctor who pointed out they've just discovered something very, very interesting. Is that when a husband and wife get together and they have the sperm fertilizes the egg and they have a zygote and it becomes a child, the child, of course, has DNA from both parents. That includes some DNA that the mother did not have. But the mother begins to pick it up from the child. And the DNA of the mother will adjust to conform to the composite. What's interesting is that's exactly what the Bible says. The two shall become one flesh. That blew me away. I thought it was interesting. But we also have a genetic defect. Retroviruses being sin positive. And as a result of that, we got disconnected from our source through our rebellion. And so we too will require the intervention of the designer. And that's why I think this idiom of the Sorcerer's Apprentice is so appropriate. Because I think this technology has a high likelihood of getting out of control in certain ways that nothing but the intervention of the designer himself will avail. Fundamental lessons to take away with, man is invading a world which he has only the faintest glimpses. We try these things and see what happens without any understanding. It's like turning a couple of kids loose in a factory, letting them push the buttons with no idea what the machines do, and redesigning it and so forth. Now, the uncharted impacts can replicate unseen, transcends borders, species, and generations. So when someone conducts a little experiment, we may not really know what the implications of that for a long time following. And again, only the most committed can persist in denying the role of a deliberate creator. We are indeed fearfully and wonderfully made. For thou hast possessed my reins, thou hast covered me in my mother's womb. I will praise thee, for I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Marvelous are thy works, and that my soul knoweth right well. Thine eyes did see my substance, yet being incomplete. And in thy book all my members were written, which in continuance were fashioned when as yet there was none of them. Psalm 139, a few portions of it. Well, where do you go from here? We've talked a lot about some technical things. Well, obviously, the newspaper and the news magazine, the media, will keep us informed to some degree what's going on in biotech. For those that are technically inclined may want to look more closely. But what all of us do need to do, for lots of other reasons besides this, but this is a good one, is we need to learn our Bible. Well, that's too big a job. Well, we've got something that may help. Our little project, we have learned the Bible in 24 hours. 24 one-hour sessions accompanied with computer animated diagrams. Now, obviously, you won't know all there is to know in the Bible in 24 hours. But you'll learn enough to be able to navigate through it wherever you'll understand how it ties together as an integral whole. You can study the individual books, and I encourage you to do that. But you still may not grasp the integrity of the whole. That's really our goal, of learning the Bible in 24 hours. 24 one-hour sessions from just Revelation, and you will emerge from that with a grasp of the total. From there, the next step would be to go to expositional commentaries, learn the Bible verse by verse, book by book, but do it against the fabric of understanding the whole. And we offer that on audio tapes, but perhaps even more productive are the CD-ROMs, because if you have a computer, you can download the audio tracks in little MP3 players to listen while you're driving or jogging or whatever, but you also get advantage of the notes. And in many cases, like in the 24-hour Bibles, the PowerPoint slides, the computer-assisted diagrams. The audio tracks are in MP3, so you can download them, and the text files are in PDF format, so you can run them off copies for your Bible study or whatever. That's perhaps the backbone of the whole thing. We also published what we call briefing packs, topical briefings, little collections of two tapes plus notes, and there are also some of them will be available on CD-ROM also. And we have over 80 of these on information, cosmic codes, the return of the Nephilim, the Creator, all kinds of topics. We have other resources. We have a new monthly news journal. Everyone in this room is entitled to, for not only a free copy of a year subscription, if you're not getting it, give us your name and address and we'll send it to you for a year in the hopes that you'll get hooked on it. But even more exciting is our internet site. We have the oldest and probably largest internet site on the net, the Christian site, that is, www.khouse.org. And on that you'll find that we monitor 10 strategic trends that are biblically relevant. We also publish a weekly bulletin on email. It's free, by the way. Get on our website and register, and we'll send you a weekly bulletin. It's a little one or two pages on what's relevant this week in world affairs, scientific, political, whatever, that are biblically relevant. And also available through the site is the Blue Letter Bible. We have English, Hebrew, or Greek text. You don't have to have know Hebrew or Greek to use it, by the way. You have commentaries, dictionaries, encyclopedias. All of this is free. All of this is word searchable. Very powerful resource that's available as just part of the ministry. And we also offer continually offering other forms of support for home Bible studies. We'll encourage all of you to get in at Bible study, and if the Lord leads you, by all means, you'll discover it's very easy to step up and lead one with the resources that are available. So that's really what we do at K-House. 1-800-K-House-1 to give us a call. We'll pay for the phone call. Or khouse.org on the net. God bless you. Good hunting.
For a complete listing of materials to further enhance your personal Bible study, or to receive a free one-year subscription to Chuck Missler's monthly Christian Intelligence News Journal, Personal Update, contact Koinonia House at 1-800-KHOUSE-1. That's 1-800-KHOUSE-1. Or you can write to Koinonia House at P.O. Box D, Coeur d'Alene, Idaho, 83816-0347. To fax your correspondence, dial 208-773-6312.